starting in the summer of 2003, I embarked on a project to tell the story of how the map was made, and which led eventually to this book that was published in December 2004 called Revolution in the Valley. Let's see if this thing works. There's the cover of the book. Turns out I found out that it was great working with O'Reilly to do the book. Fantastic people, understood what I was doing. It came from a website, so I was afraid that, and I was really insistent that the website I felt was the main thing I was doing, and that I didn't want to take it down, you know, when the book's awful content was available for free, and that might have daunted some publishers, but O'Reilly really understood how it was synergistic and let me continue to do the website well. But as it turns out, once it got down to the cover and the title of the book, they were a little more difficult to work with. I guess because you can't judge a book by its cover. They didn't like my title, so and they didn't like my ideas for the cover. I found out I had very little say in the cover and the title. I was calling it Mac Folklore, like my website. They proposed revolutionaries in the valley, which I thought was a bit arrogant and stuff. Finally, we compromised. At least I was able to shorten it a little bit, and revolution sounded a little, it's just slightly more modest, but probably not modest enough. And then the cover with the red background when I first saw it kind of freaked me out, especially because they also had a bunch of yellow stars. And it was supposed to be like the communist revolution, which I got to get rid of the yellow stars at least. But the sort of most frustrating thing when finally I said, well, you know, I just really don't like this cover. They said to me, you're not supposed to. It's designed for young people. the target market, I'm not in it. So what I said didn't really matter. It turns out the book was translated into Japanese last year. So there's a Japanese version. The Japanese translator was just great. He was maybe an order of magnitude more diligent than my American editors, and in the course of just going over the translation with them, we found about 20 or 30 bugs in the original text, which were fixed in the Japanese. Actually people have asked me, because I write a lot of code, this is the first time I've ever written a big mass of prose like this, and people ask, well, how's it different writing a lot of prose from a lot of code? And the biggest similarity, I think, is there's an infinite capacity for bugs in both of them. And even after the book was out for a while, all the stories, as you'll see, were aired out on a website for about a year before the book was published. And then even after the book was published, and we found lots of errata, it went into a second printing, so we were able to fix some of them. But then we still kept finding horrible bugs. The most embarrassing thing that's even in the second edition of the book, at one point I refer to Robert Noyce as the inventor of the semiconductor, which he was the inventor of the integrated circuit. And so it was just amazing to me that it was that mistake was there on the web for about a year and a half, and no one pointed it out to me. But so anyway, the book, I never set out to write a book. What motivated this project was an idea I had in 2003. To use the web for what I call collective historical storytelling, to allow a group of people to tell their shared story using the web to collaborate. I've been telling my anecdotes about the development of the Mac to my colleagues and friends for years, but I was really hesitant to write them down because, for one thing, there were a lot of other self-serving histories of Apple that came out. Such as John Sculley's book is one example, or just about everyone who's written a book about Apple has had their own perspective that sort of elevates themselves, and I didn't want to do that. And so finally I came up with the idea of airing out the stories, publishing them on the web, and inviting others to join me. I originally wrote about 20 stories and then wrote a unique content management system I just called the Folklore software to publish them on the web. And then I started cajoling all my friends who worked on the Mac to contribute stories. I was only partially successful. I got three or four of the main team members I got to write stories. A lot of other people cooperated with me. They just didn't want to write. And eventually we got maybe about 15 or 20 authors to submit stories to the site, but that was disappointing. I wanted more. Right now, on the site, I think there's about 120 stories, and I guess about 80% of them or so were written by me. This was taken when there were 160. There's, I think, 118 now. But so this is just the basic structure of the site. Not only are there stories, but there's some interesting metadata. People can leave comments, which I thought were very important because I knew I was going to get things wrong, and I wanted people to be able to correct me. And the book includes maybe about 30 different comments from people, a few of which pointed out some of my mistakes. What's interesting, what was very helpful to me, actually, when I was still writing the book, was the fact that readers could rate the stories 1 to 5 stars. So it gave me a little bit of a real-time feedback mechanism to figure out what people liked. And I found, in general, the wisdom of the crowd is pretty good. The stories that I thought were the best anyway were the ones that people liked the most. So this is what an individual story looks like on the site. You can see there's metadata for characters and topics, as well as the ratings and comments. And sort of probably the single most interesting feature of the story is some of that's maintained automatically. If you mention someone's first or last name in the text, it'll automatically add the character, which you can further edit. This is what the editing view looks like. So you can see there's an area here for manipulating that metadata. But I found that, you know, it's hard to get all the characters right, and when I put in that automatic feature, it helped me get a more comprehensive list of characters. Unfortunately, the state of the software is not a good story. Didn't work out like I wanted it to. I was intending on releasing it as free software, and I sort of did. But as you guys probably know, it's one thing to create a site for yourself that you're, you know, the person who wrote the code administers the code. Well, that's easy. You know, you just went every time there's a problem, you fix it. It's probably about an order of magnitude harder to release something for general use. And I never got either enough volunteers to help or enough interest to really justify making a polished release. So I have released it sort of privately to everyone who's asked, maybe about a dozen different people. But at least to this point, I haven't been motivated to do that hard grunt work. The creative part is fun. The shipping part is always been my problem, actually. Well, probably will continue to be at Google. I'm so much better at starting things than finishing. That's the way it goes. And so anyway, I developed the site. I had maybe about 50 stories on it when I started. I was showing it around to all the Mac team members. To try to get them to contribute, and then to a few other smart people I know. I showed it to Tim O'Reilly in October 2003, and he became very enthusiastic about turning it into a book. I was a little wary because I had, like, just going back here, like you can see here, one of the motivating things to me was the idea of how does a group of people tell a story together? And I thought the web might be ideally suited to that because of the linking. You know, sort of the very heart of the web is the link. And so the idea is if you can write interlinked stories, it allows a group of people to indefinitely elaborate a story, keeping their own unique perspectives. And so my fear in turning it into a book is I'd have to, instead of having these bite-sized little anecdotes, we have to make it into a continuous narrative, and it would be sort of incompatible with the site. But Tim was very enthusiastic about saying, "Oh no, this structure that you have on the site would work well as a book." And then once I understood that I could essentially keep the same structure, the book became a pretty appealing idea to me. And eventually, I guess now I think of the book sort of as at least as important or more important as the site. Someday, you know, my server will go down and the site won't be there anymore. But the book will, you know, get enough copies out there; it'll last for a long time. Anyway, this is what the book looks like. I figured I'd include a few slides. You can't really quite do it justice in the two-page layout, but the book has, what I wanted to show is it has nice production values. We decided in turning the site to the book, to take advantage of the higher resolution that we had on the printed page than the computer screen, so we wanted to make it very graphically rich. The far and away the hardest part of turning the website into the book was getting the rights to all the images. On the web, you can be really fast and loose. You know, what I would do is when I needed a picture, just go to Google image search, type in the right term, found a picture on someone else's site, I just put it up there on my site, figuring if anyone complained, I'd just take it down. But that doesn't work for the printed page. It's much, much harder to undo. And rightly so, my publisher insisted that nothing could go into the book unless we had all of the rights secured. Now, some of this material is that I wanted to include, it was over 20 years old. It's really hard to track down the rights. So eventually O'Reilly set me up with two different consultants who I paid $50 for each right they secured for the photographs. And still, maybe I could only get 80% of the ones that I wanted. These images here were from the 1984 commercial. I'll talk a little bit how Apple was pretty gracious in collaborating with me. And eventually I got a nice thank you letter from this guy who played Big Brother. Where I had to pay him $100, so I had to write a personal check for him. And he wrote a very gracious thank you letter. Unfortunately, I found out Anya Miner, the woman who throws a sledgehammer, had died about 5 years earlier of breast cancer. So that was kind of sad. This is one of the nicest spreads in the book. Is this story I call "Busy Being Born" after a Bob Dylan lyric that shows in Polaroid photographs taken by Bill Atkinson, the main designer of the graphics and user interface for the Mac of the Evolution. It was disappointing though in that we couldn't quite print the pictures large enough, so they're a little bit muddy on the book. I think when you click on them, at least you see very large versions on the site. Turns out a little better. This is one of my favorite photographs of the software team in a pyramid that's about a pyramid scheme about to collapse. It only lasted for maybe about 3 seconds before we were all on the ground. But the images actually, it's an interesting story. I have a lot of Steve Jobs stories in my book. But another story was when I first showed the site to Steve. You know, I was kind of scared because I know he's not afraid of expressing negative opinions. I thought about showing it to him for a few months before I finally did, but I finally got up my courage and showed it to him, and he said, and I was surprised. You know, I sent off an email with a link. He emailed back right away saying, "Hey, it's great, you know, I really like it, except the image quality sucks." I said, "Well, you know, these are 20-year-old images, I don't have good copies." And finally, he suggested to me that I visit the Apple corporate marketing archive, where they have a lot of the originals of their marketing materials. I had no idea there was an Apple corporate marketing archive. Most people at Apple don't either. Turns out it's just this one room, just crammed to the gills with all this old marketing material, completely disorganized. But I spent, they had a very cooperative curator named Del Penny, and I spent about a week with him just going everything. He had about a third of it indexed in an old FileMaker database. And the rest of it you just had to go through by hand, but we were eventually, including this picture, we were able to find some good gems to include on. Most of them were on 35mm slides, which I scanned at high resolution, so they're suitable for the book. This is another. I like this spread because this is the Defender video game that we played endlessly while developing the Mac. Defender came out, I think, right about the time we started working on the Mac. By the time the Mac came out, some of the team members were very, very good at the game. This story tells about Burl Smith, who's the hardware genius responsible for the digital hardware of the Mac. He had a very unique strategy for playing Defender. If you know the Defender game, the object is to protect these little humans. And of course, this being 1981, the humans were, you know, maybe about 10 pixels worth of human at the bottom of the screen. You can see them here. These are the little humans. And you have to defend them from these aliens that would go down and pick them up. And if an alien successfully carried a human to the top of the screen, they turn into a mutant. Which means they would move about 3 times as fast and be about 4 times as hard to evade. And so Burl's unique strategy was he began the game by killing all of his humans. And the last human is gone, all the aliens turn into mutants, which are really hard to defend against. But Burl did that because he wanted to create the worst case situation, the hardest challenge, so he could practice evading it. And sure enough, it took him a few weeks, but in a few weeks he got great at avoiding mutants. So he became the best player anyone's ever seen at Defender. But the name was sort of Make a Mess, Clean It Up. That was Burl's, sort of the way he titled his unique strategy. I included this one just because I love this picture of Bill and Steve. Bill being really the main genius behind the creative part of the Mac, and Steve being the main beneficiary of the Mac. I think this picture really shows it. Bill is just proud of what he's done, but Steve's got something schemey going on. By the way, this picture and many of the great pictures I have in my book were taken by Norman Seeff, who was the Rolling Stone photographer, one of the great coups we got for the Macintosh initial release was we talked Rolling Stone into doing an article. They sent out a rock star photographer who had just come from photographing Fleetwood Mac. So we were pretty impressed. He had a beautiful French assistant and stuff. And he's a great photographer. And these pictures, I think his pictures really, really stick out. I think that's probably the last one. So now what I think I'll do with this talk is rather than retell the stories in the book, just to tell a lot of great anecdotes that didn't make it into the book for one reason or the other. I have a few pictures. I'll show you one. I have one really great picture that I was too chicken to print in the book. My editors begged me to print it, and you'll see that one in a little while. So some of what I'll show are sort of the outtakes, the things that didn't quite make it into the book. But also I have a whole bunch of stories that just weren't in the book due to the time frame. One of the hard parts about doing something like this is, where do you start? Where do you stop? It's really a continuous story from Apple's founding. By the way, Apple, in just 2 weeks, will be celebrating their 30th birthday. And really, when I think about that, it just makes me feel really old. Apple being 30. So anyway, people, it's sort of a bit forgotten in the mists of history, except for old people like me, but the Macintosh had a very distinguished and tremendous predecessor. The Macintosh's kind of mentor, if you will, was the amazing Apple II computer, and that's really what drew me to Apple, what inspired the Macintosh team. And so I want to talk just a little bit about some of the Apple II stories and the anecdotes involving creating the Apple II, which really changed my life. I begin my book saying that when I purchased my Apple II, my 16K Apple II, 16K bytes of RAM, when you think about that these days, that's 0.015 megabytes of memory. I won't even try to say how many leading zeros there are to express it in terms of gigabytes. Most people today have a gigabyte. So just a smidgen of memory, even though it costs more than the original Apple II when it debuted in April 1977 at the first West Coast Computer Fair, cost $1,700 was its list price. I was at that first West Coast Computer Fair. I was a grad student at UC Berkeley, and the Apple II immediately was the one I fell in love with because of its high-res color graphics. When I first saw the Apple II, at least in my memory now, it sort of has a halo around it. It was so special. The only problem was I couldn't afford it. It was priced out of my range. I was just a lowly graduate student, and it cost about a year's worth of college of tuition. Just too expensive for me. But luckily, they had a $400 off sale in January 1978, about 8 months after it debuted. And that was just enough to get it down to the affordability range for me. So I bought my Apple II in mid-January 1978 and learned one of the first lessons of the computer industry. When I bought my Apple II for $12.95, they had this one-time $400 off sale. 2 months later, they permanently lowered the price to
$11.95.
So if I had waited another month or two, I could have saved an extra $100. But I'm glad I bought it when I did. Eventually, I started spending all of my free time with the Apple II. It just fascinated me because when I dug into the technology, I saw that it wasn't an ordinary product in any sense of the word. It was created by a sort of a madman genius. When you read the code of the Apple II, it was crazy. It was not programmed like they were teaching us in school, using self-modifying reiterate code. Sometimes you jump in the middle of instructions for various things, and you could see it had this passionate creativity oozing out of it in so many different ways. It was pointed out to me I misspelled hobbyist. I tried it with the Y, but that didn't look right either. In the beginning, when I first got my Apple II, there was no personal computer market, no commercial software market. Literally, no software was sold for the Apple II, but there was an enthusiastic group of hobbyists, most of them hanging out in the computer store. I would hang out in the two computerware store, what were they called, computer land stores nearest to me, the San Francisco one and the one in El Cerrito, for months before I bought my Apple II, after I recognized it as the one I wanted to get before I could afford it. I just hang out in the store to see what people were doing with it. What I didn't realize is after you bought it, you'd also go hang out in the store because you were looking for new software, and people who were writing software would bring it in. I put these hobbyist magazines up there just because this popular electronics one is really famous, and rightly so, you could say it really kicked off the personal computer revolution, the personal computer industry, by featuring popular electronics. It isn't a computer hobbyist magazine, it was just electronics hobbyist magazine, but it announced to the world that an affordable microcomputer, which was really the repercussion of Intel making the first affordable microprocessor, was finally there. So everyone who had a dream of owning their own computer finally could. My problem was that I'm clumsy with a soldering iron. So these kits, that first generation of personal computers that started in the fall of 1975, you really had to be adept with hardware to use it at all. And the Apple II was really one of the very first ones, that along with the Commodore PET. The TRS-80 came just a little bit later. But they were the first ones that were suitable for a software hobbyist like myself. As I said, we would all the Apple II owners would hang out in the computer store looking for kindred spirits. But finally, in April 1st, 1978, they started the first Apple II club in the Bay Area, the San Francisco Apple Corps. Another April Fool's joke. Google has a nice tradition of April Fool's jokes and making interesting announcements on April Fool's Day. Apple also did. Apple was founded on April Fool's Day. So Apple's first birthday, which is just coming up, that's April 1st, 1976, Apple was founded. So what do you do when you got the Apple II? Well, you start writing programs and giving them away. So my very first two significant programs that I wrote and gave away to the club, the first one was called Mother's Little Helper. It was intended to be a music-generating program. The Apple II had sound capability, but zillion of the tricks in the Apple II, Woz would get great features for free, just using software for what other people would spend hardware on. So really, what the Apple II had was the machine address CO30. When you made a memory reference to it, it would click the speaker. That was the full extent of the Apple II sound. But luckily, you had a microprocessor there that could click that speaker many, many times a second with great precision. So by writing the right software loops, you could generate music. And they had a little example program in the Red Book, the classic first documentation that was actually compiled by the president of Apple, Mike Scott. Apple didn't have a pubs department when the Apple II came out, so literally the president of the company Xeroxed all of the documentation that was lying around, and they published it. That was in the days before the Red Book. When I got my out, it's called the Red Book because it had a nice red cover, but the Red Book didn't come out until the summer of 1978. You just got the sort of loose leaf collection of random documentation at first. But it had the sound assembly language sound generating machine. I wasn't doing assembly language on the Apple II yet, but you could poke it into memory with BASIC, just specifying the opcodes as things. So I wrote a little music generating program, and the first song that I entered into it was the Rolling Stones song, Mother's Little Helper. I don't know exactly why I picked that one, but it had something to do with the early Apple II ads. I don't know if anyone, I tried to get that to show on the slide, but I couldn't quite find it. But there was the very first ad, or the big spread ad for the Apple II was a husband using the Apple II on the kitchen table doing financial presentations while his adoring wife was doing the dishes, beating at him, so proud of him for using a personal computer. So I don't know, Mother's Little Helper just seemed right. And it was intended to be a general purpose sound editor where you can enter any song, but I never finished it to that point. I got it to play Mother's Little Helper and went on to other things. But I gave it away to the club. I called it Sound Edit, but then they saw that it didn't really have or Music Editor, that was my title, but the club, when the club members saw that, all it really did was play Mother's Little Helper, they changed the name to that. My next program was an I Ching. You could say it was a game, but what I did was I had read Philip K. Dick's novel, The Man in the High Castle, which is a great science fiction work that's in many ways based on the I Ching. And I thought there was something about the digital nature of the computer that seemed similar to the digital nature of an I Ching hexagram. So what I did was I flashed the lines of the hexagram on and off as fast as the Apple II could, about 100 times a second. When you hit the game paddle, it would stop, essentially picking one of the two states. When you did that six times, it would interpret your hexagram for you. So that was the second program I gave away. But the most exciting thing that came about from attending those club meetings was I got to meet Steve Wozniak, who by that time was just my absolute hero. I was so intoxicated with the magic of the Apple II. I just could barely imagine that a human could have created it. So the chance to meet the creator of the Apple II was just tremendous. So I met Woz at that January 1978 Apple Corps meeting, and I was lucky enough to go out to lunch with him and John Draper at a place in Berkeley called Larry Blake's. The main thing I remember from that was getting a little bit scared, because John Draper, by the way, was also known as Captain Crunch, one of the very first phone hackers. Woz had a career as a blue box manufacturer before designing the Apple II, so he was friends with Draper. And at the lunch, what they were talking about were schemes for taking over communication satellites. Wait, we could take over the satellite, and Woz wanted to broadcast like some joke they were plotting to do. I was thinking, am I going to get arrested? Anyway, I started, the first thing I did with my software was give it away to the club. After I started writing slightly more elaborate programs, I started publishing them in the hobbyist magazines. That last magazine over there, Dr. Dobbs Journal, is where I published my first two articles. The reason I picked Dr. Dobbs, by the way, by that point I was seriously idolizing Steve Wozniak, and he had printed an article I had read in Dr. Dobbs about the Sweet 16 interpreter that was built in the Apple II. Among other magical things in the Apple II, it had a little 16-bit virtual machine that you can use just by UJSR. You made a subroutine call into the ROM, and then it interpreted everything after the return address as opcodes of this virtual instruction set. And so I wrote a program using Sweet 16 to resurrect integer BASIC programs that were accidentally deleted. I realized that it was pretty easy just by typing one wrong character to delete the program you were working on. The Apple II had no good mass storage anyway at that point to save it. So that was kind of precarious. And I realized you could recognize the structure of the basic program, like by looking for certain tokens that were used to begin every program, so I could write a little program to scan through memory to bring back your integer basic program after you accidentally deleted it. I called it Lazarus, and I wrote an article and printed it in Dr. Dobbs. I sent it away to them and was a little sad that they didn't respond to me. I thought, you know, after a week or two, they'd either say, yes, we publish it, no, we didn't. But then after a month, I got a big package in the mail with six issues of Dr. Dobbs with my article in it. They never formally accepted it or anything. They just printed it. But what I remember most about that article was I was carefully putting jokes in my article in exactly the places that Woz had jokes in his article. Slavishly emulating him. So my... all that led to me becoming an Apple employee. I started at Apple in August 1979, less than 18 months after I bought my Apple II. Just the magic of the Apple II drew me to Apple like a moth to the flame. And, you know, it was like ascending Mount Olympus to go to Apple. The gods, the heroes that I worshipped, I got to work alongside them. And I began to learn all the company stories, some of the ones I'm telling you today, firsthand from the people who created the company. Of course, the biggest topic that everyone talked about was stock options, because at that time I was completely naive as just a student, really. I didn't know anything about it. But you learn really fast when that's what everyone talks about. And I thought I should mention just a little bit of a cautionary tale. Maybe I shouldn't mention this, but... when I was offered the job at Apple in January 1979, I just skipped over a story. I got introduced to Steve Jobs, actually. I wrote a program called Keyboard Filter that solved one of the weaknesses of the original Apple II was it didn't have lowercase letters. And it's hard to believe today that you design a computer, no lowercase letters. But that was, the reason for that is the standard ROM chips that were cheap just didn't have, the character generator chips didn't have the lowercase letters. But I realized the high resolution graphics, you can use the graphics screen to draw anything you wanted. So I did a character generator program. It was pretty clever. It had features like it even had colored letters and stuff that were kind of hard to do because of some of the oddities of the Apple II screen. Anyway, I was going to publish that in Dr. Dobbs' journal when a friend of mine who was also an Apple II hobbyist said, are you crazy? You could sell that. You could make $10,000. And so, you know, how could I possibly want to just give it away in a magazine? So I said, well, I don't know how to do that. How am I going to possibly sell this thing? There wasn't even really much of a personal computer industry at that point. He goes, don't worry, I'll sell it for you. Just give me half the money. And so I said, sure. Because half the money was, that sounded good to me too. And so we started taking it around to all these little companies that were just beginning to form. And each company we took it to, they surprised us saying, yeah, we want to publish this. So we immediately thought, oh, they must not be big enough if they actually want to do it. And so after about three iterations of that, we ended up at Apple. In December of 1978 with a meeting with Steve Jobs. Sure enough, even Steve liked the program and he wanted to publish it. We had a handshake deal with him, but it turns out Steve didn't call me up, but his assistant called me up about 2 weeks later saying they changed their mind. Because my program was intended to occupy one of the blank ROM slots in the Apple II. The Apple II had 4K of address space devoted to system software in the ROM, but only 3K of it was actually used. It had the D800 address space, was just empty. So I thought, hey, I got just the thing to fill that up. But it turns out after Apple had seen my program, they made a decision to put the floating point basic, written by Microsoft, incidentally, and that had repercussions we might get around to talking to later, into the ROM instead of my character generator. So they didn't want that, but they wanted to hire me. They made me a nice job offer in January of 1979. But at that point, I was a grad student at UC Berkeley in the PhD program. I had passed my prelims, which was kind of painful. I thought I should stick around to at least get a master's degree. So I thought, well, I couldn't accept the job until the summer to give me time to finish my master's degree. The cautionary tale is I missed a 4-to-1 Apple stock split at that time, which was worth, on the day of Apple's IPO, about $2 million. So my master's degree had a price. The very first product I worked on at Apple was a low-cost thermal printer called the Silentype. And I was really excited to work on this project because I was a real aficionado of the Apple II disk drive, which was really Steve Wozniak's crowning achievement. And what he did with the Apple II disk drive was take an industry standard disk drive, the Shugart 400, and throw away the controller board. The controller board on the disk drive itself had about 15 chips on it, and then usually you'd need an interface card that would plug into the computer with another 15 chips on it. But Woz realized that all of that stuff could be done in software, so they replaced both cards with an order of magnitude less chips. Woz's disk controller card only had 5 chips on it instead of the typical 20 chips on a disk controller card. And because he was free in the software to use innovative encoding schemes, it was also significantly faster, maybe about 50% faster than the standard drives, and it contained 25% more data, later to be 40% more data as he improved the software. And so the Silentype was the same general idea. There was a little company manufacturing a thermal printer in Sunnyvale called Trencom, and Apple decided we could replace that board that was inside the printer that had about 20 chips on it with a very, very simple interface and do all of the timing. It's remove the microprocessor from that board, which was the most expensive component, and just use the microprocessor of the Apple II. And that was my job, because I was already a pretty accomplished 65-bit assembly language programmer that time, so I quickly learned how a lot about thermal printing, how you had to model in the software the temperature of each printhead. To get it up to the right temperature to print your dot. And Victor Bull, who was the hardware designer on it, when he was explaining it to me, told me about how, well, it was a little bit dangerous, this technique. You know, he was worried that if the software crashed, you could leave a printhead on, and it would just get hotter and hotter and hotter. But he had a solution for that. He built a little timer. It was a little tiny timer chip called the 555 timer that would turn off the printhead if it was left on for more than 6 milliseconds. You should never leave it on for more than 6 milliseconds. So if the software got hung or something and you left it on for more than 6 milliseconds, it would turn it off. So I began to think, well, I wonder what would happen if you left it on for 5.9 milliseconds and you turned it off for a microsecond or so. So that was a very satisfying program to write because the first time I ran it, I managed to make the paper break out into open flames. Of course, destroying the printhead in the process, but it was probably the coolest demo I've ever had. The definitive hot product. So I wanted to talk a little bit about Steve Wozniak, my hero, and the guy who designed both the hardware and the software for the Apple II. For a while, Steve Jobs just kind of, by association, got sort of credit for the software for the Apple II, just because there were two founders, and they didn't think, well, one of them did both the hardware and the software. And occasionally, Steve Jobs would take credit for the software unless Woz was around, and then finally goes, well, I helped Woz. Well, yeah, you helped me, you watched me, right? But the Apple II was unique as a product because it wasn't really conceived of as a product. It was really a labor of love. Woz loved computers. He grew up, his dad was an engineer, he was exposed at an early age, and like in his high school math classes, when most kids were bored or daydreaming about playing basketball, Woz was designing microprocessors in his notebook, bored with the class. He had a picture, most kids would have a picture of, a sports star in the room. Woz had a poster of the Data General Nova in high school, which was his favorite mini computer. Turns out he did his own implementation of the Nova and was shocked when he was 16 years old. And he was shocked when he sent away for the real schematics and his implementation had about half the chips that the real product did. Extremely talented guy. I have a great story about he would really the thing that motivated both the Apple I and the Apple II were these homebrew computer club meetings. Just very similar to my experience with the Apple Corps meetings. You'd stay up the night before the meeting. The meetings were once a month just to finish up whatever you were working on so you could give it away at the club. And so Woz would add cooling features to the Apple II just so he could impress people at the homebrew club. And really, the most impressive single piece of technology, there were so many, so maybe it's not the most impressive, but Woz wrote an entire basic interpreter that was, it turned out his interpreter ran about four times faster than Microsoft's, which eventually replaced it in the RAM, but it was just an integer basic. It didn't have the floating point routines. But a great story was because Woz, the Apple II didn't have any mass storage. So when he when he wanted to demo his basic interpreter at the homebrew computer club, he typed it in from memory, about 4K worth of code. And so I wasn't at these homebrew meetings, but I heard how the story goes. Woz is sitting. Woz also could type faster than anybody else you've ever seen. So he'd be typing away a mile a minute and then pause for a few seconds. And then he'd be typing away again and pausing. And someone asked him, well, why are you pausing? And he goes, forward branch. Turns out what he did was he couldn't really memorize it all. He could just memorize the basic structure, so he would essentially write it in his head as he was doing it. And when he got to a forward branch, he'd have to do a few instructions ahead to compute the branch offset. So that's just an amazing feat. When I got to know Woz better, I saw that he was an incredible storyteller and prankster. Woz is working on his own book that's going to be focused on his pranks. But he would pull all kinds of pranks. One of the ones I remember, because there was a restaurant near Apple called Bob's Big Boy that he and Randy Wigginton would go eat all the time. And their food was a little questionable. So one day Woz brought in a stapler and these travel packs of Alka-Seltzer. And he stapled the Alka-Seltzer to the menu, figuring he'd do a service. So maybe it was a warning, or I'm not sure. But he would do all kinds of things like that. First project was, so one of my great pleasures of beginning to work at Apple is they put me in a desk only two desks away from Woz, and I got to see what he was working on. And he was always working on different crazy projects, whatever caught his fancy. When I first started, he was busy. He wrote a program to calculate the mathematical constant E to a great deal of precision. He came up with a unique algorithm that didn't use any intermediate results. It was just one big number, and he could make successive passes through memory, just each pass computing more digits, refining this long, using all 48K in the Apple II for one big number. The problem, and then he even used the screen space, the graphic space, to hold the number. So, and you could see each pass as it rippled through. It would take it about 2 minutes to do each iteration. And so about every 2 minutes, you'd see it ripple through the graphics memory. So that's how you could tell it was running. Well, the program took about 3 weeks to compute the 100,000 digits. And the Apple II's mean time between failure was probably closer to 2 weeks. So it took him quite a few iterations to finally get the whole thing to run. And so Woz would be, for this period of time, which is when I first started Apple, you'd go to Woz saying, do you have time to help me with this? He goes, no, I'm busy. What are you doing? I'm computing E. Of course, the computer was doing most of the work. You have another funny story about Woz's personality. Maybe I shouldn't tell this one, but I will. But one of the sad and shocking things is Woz got into a bad plane crash just before I started working on the Mac project in February 1981. By that time, I was decent friends with him, and luckily, he got pretty banged up, but nothing fundamental was broken. But he lost his memory for a few weeks, causing him to pop his face. He also lost two teeth. In the plane crash, and at one point he had a theory of memories are stored in your teeth, and that's why kids remember their early childhood. Woz's dad called me up shortly after the accident to ask me if I was willing to help up. Woz's dad, when the accident happened, Woz's affairs were in disarray. One of the stories Woz's dad told me was after the accident, he went to Woz's car just to clean it up for a few loose ends, and he found $200,000 of uncashed checks in the back seat of the car. Woz was kind of disorganized. Anyway, I got a call at work. Woz's dad I guess the psychiatrist who was evaluating Woz after, because Woz had a bad blow to the head, and sometimes that causes people's personalities to change or whatever, so they had a psychiatrist evaluate him, and Woz's dad for some of Woz's friends, so I was at work, and the psychiatrist calls me up saying, you know, I think there's a real problem here. This blow to the head affected his behavior. And he starts, oh, what do you mean? He goes, well, you know, he's like constantly trying to get people to smuggle in pizzas to him, and he's trying to escape, and he's like fiddling with the television sets in the other room. And I said, well, you know, he thought the blow to his head had changed his personality. I go, no, no, that's what it was. Psychiatrist just wasn't used to patients like that, I think. But yeah, but actually, I visited Woz in the hospital at that time, and he did get me, he managed to twist my arm to smuggle in a pizza. He ate the hospital food. It was just a fun game, I guess, more than the fact that he really liked pizza. Anyway, here's a picture of the disc two. As I say, probably Woz's crowning achievement. And these are interesting stories to tell because they center around copy protection. As the commercial software market started developing for the Apple II in 1979, VisiCalc was the first real commercial program with business possibilities that was really worth buying. It was also one of the first commercial programs aside from the games with copy protection. In those days, when a new game came out, one person at Apple would buy the game, and then they deliver it to all these people who were experts in the details of the disk drive to break the copy protection. And myself, I loved how the disk drive worked. I became a real expert in the intricacies of it. So I competed with two or three other people at Apple as soon as a game came in to see who could be the first to break the copy protection. I'd win, maybe about a third of the time or so. But you'd devise a patch. Patch it, and then everyone at Apple could play the game. So anyway, Woz was above that. He wasn't about to invest time in breaking copy protections of games. He had millions of dollars. He'd just buy the games. But finally, when VisiCalc came out, that one piqued his interest. It had a copy protection. Woz wanted to give a copy to his brother. And so he decided he would dive in and figure out the copy protection and break it. And it took him about 50 minutes. It actually had a really relatively simple copy protection scheme. As these things always go, they escalate over time in a kind of spy, counter-spy type thing. As the copy protection, as the people breaking the protections get more sophisticated, you get more sophisticated protections in a vicious cycle. But this was still pretty early in the game. What you have to do to break the copy protection is disassemble through the program in various ways. The Apple II had a built-in disassembler that kind of made it easier than it might have been. But one of the things Woz noticed as he was disassembling to remove the copy protection was that the floating point routines of VisiCalc, which were pretty crucial because it was based on floating point math, were not efficiently coded for the 6502. Woz had already written his own. So besides breaking the copy protection of VisiCalc, he also sped up the math routines by a factor of three. And he thought that was worthwhile enough to distribute more widely. So he wrote a little program that would take a VisiCalc disk, you'd stick it in there, and it would spit out this improved VisiCalc. No copy protection and three times faster math routines. And he named that program VisiCrook. I got involved because I had written a nice, elaborate proportional text character generator. Woz asked me to make a nice logo for the a splash screen for VisiCrook. I don't know how widely VisiCrook ever got distributed, but it was very popular at Apple at least. But then, about a week or so after he wrote VisiCrook, he started thinking, well, geez, another program showed up on his doorstep that had a different copy protection. And he realized that eventually he'd have to be spending all his time breaking copy protections. He didn't want to do that. So he realized that he could write a general purpose copy scheme that would use all these copy protections worked really by essentially changing the disk format, like biasing the checksum, so more of the normal disk routines would just get errors when it was reading it. He realized he could write a copy program that worked a lower level at the sort of transition level instead of the block level of the disk routines, and so it wouldn't care about copy protection. It would just copy the bits on the disk. That was kind of tricky because all of the information, every transition on the disk wasn't really accessible to the software, but it was accessible to the disk controller. It had this scheme called self-synchronization, where it would slip to synchronize with the transition stream on the disk. It would slip transitions every once in a while. The controller would use transitions for syncing instead of reading them back out. So Woz made a little hardware card with just one wire on it, or it attached one wire to the disk controller card so he can copy, he could get access to all the transitions, and he wrote a simple little copy. He called it a nibble copy, but we all called it Woz copy. that would sure enough, it would not only copy any copy protected disk, but the copy protection would be preserved intact. Because it wasn't patching the software, it was just literally copying the disk at the transition level. So he thought that was a little more ethical too. He wasn't breaking it for everyone, but he was empowered because it used this hardware card as well. The software couldn't get loose. Turns out he showed it to me. Let me see the source code. I modified the program so it wouldn't need the hardware card just by guessing. The sync would be most of the time in obvious places. So I traded a little bit of robustness by making assumptions about where the sync would be for the ability for it to run for everybody. But anyway, Woz was happy with the nibble copy. But a few weeks after that, I saw him working feverishly in the hardware lab. And usually Woz wasn't in the hardware lab. I asked him, what are you doing? He goes, oh, I'm making the fuzz box. He started thinking, well, what if he wanted to publish a piece of software with copy protection and someone had access to his nibble copy program? How could he thwart them? Well, he realized that the nibble copy program had to make assumptions about the, it would turn soft errors into hard errors. It had no way of doing checksums, right? Because it can't assume any particular disk format. So he realized he could make a hardware card that would randomly, the way the disk 2 worked was the transitions were either 4 microseconds or 8 microseconds, which sounds really long by today's standards. But it was actually pretty hard to write a loop on the Apple II to deal with 4 microsecond transitions because the instructions each took a microsecond. It was hard to get around the loop. Anyway, he modified the disk controller card to put a potentiometer on it that would stretch the transitions. Just in analog hardware. And so he could adjust the potentiometer he would turn 4 microsecond transitions randomly into 6 microsecond transitions. And if it was 6, it could be read as a 4 or an 8 equally. And so you had to know the disk format. You had to, because he would introduce on purpose such a high error rate that you could read it if you knew it how to retry. If you knew when you got it right, it could try enough until it got it. But if you didn't, there was no way to read it. So he thought he had definitively thwarted the nibble copy with this fuzz box thing, which of course was never distributed. It was just Woz battling the copy protection wars at an order of magnitude level of sophistication than anyone else, because he's a genius and he invented the disk drive. Anyway, the final punchline of the story is, a few weeks after that, I walked into work and there was this funny smell coming from Woz's cubicle, like burning plastic. I was wondering what it was, and he had a laundry iron at his desk, and he was busy ironing some floppy disks. What are you doing? What could you possibly be trying to do? He goes, well, I started thinking, what if someone got the fuzz box and used it to make a program that I wanted to copy? What could I do? And so then he kind of realized, well, if he heated the floppy disk up to the Curie point, the magnetism would transfer. So if he could precisely heat a floppy disk up to the right temperature and put another one on top of it, it would make a perfect copy of the buzz box disk. Meanwhile, it was really, really hard to get it to the right temperature. What really would happen is the disks would turn into this globby mess with an acrid smell. And so I watched Woz doing this for an hour or so, and I just said to him, you're never going to get this to work. And he quickly said to me, you want to make a bet? I knew there had to be something wrong because he was too quick to want to make a bet. But I said, sure, I'll bet you. He goes, okay, I'll bet you $50, I will get this to work. And I said, no, you'll never get it to work. We made the bet. And So it finally was tried it for another few hours. He worked on it a little bit sporadically over the next few weeks. Finally, he gave up. He was never able to make it to work. So a few weeks later, I said, hey, boss, I guess you owe me $50. He goes, no, I don't. And I said, well, what do you mean? We made a bet. I bet you'd never get it to work. He goes, I'm still trying. So the punchline was, I used the word never. And Waz astutely realized that never will never arrive. Even today, if I ask him for the $50, he'll say, I'm still trying. So this brings us to the Mac project. Turns out the Mac project, you know, was started by an interesting character named Jeff Raskin, who's in this picture in the middle. This is an example of a picture I wanted to use in the book, but couldn't. It was a collage that was made by an artist at for Popular Science magazine to celebrate the Mac's 10th birthday, where they took some other pictures and collaged them together. I thought they did a beautiful job. This was one of the ones that was just so old we couldn't track down the permissions, and we couldn't use it. But I thought it was a nice one to include here. And Jeff Raskin, who was Apple employee, I think number 38, he started at Apple. Actually, I have another slide where I talk more about Jeff, where he had a consulting company called Bannister and Crumb, named after characters on The Goon Show, which is an old English TV show that most people don't know. It was really, I'm not sure who was Bannister and who was Crumb, but it was Jeff Raskin and his cohort Brian Howard. He was Apple employee 31, and he was hired to start the Pubs Group. He was actually hired to write the manager for Integer Basic when Apple was still in Steve Jobs' parents' garage. They did such a great job that they hired Jeff to start the Pubs Group at Apple. And Jeff here's a story I just remembered about Jeff. It tells a lot about his personality, which is when I first met Jeff, the Friday evening of my first week at Apple, I went out to dinner with a bunch of Apple employees. Jeff was there. He sat down next to me, and the first thing he ever said to me, he goes, you know, I'm not only a mathematical genius, but I'm a musical genius as well. What do you say to that? I said, good for you. And Jeff really was an incredibly creative person, but he also, had quite an ego. But he conceived that of the idea of making a consumer-oriented, very low-cost, and therefore very high-volume computer, and the key to doing that would be extreme ease of use. And Jeff was really ahead of the curve thinking about how to simplify. He saw the greatness of the Apple II. For all of its greatness, it was still not even close to being usable by an ordinary individual. And he thought he could fix that. And so he started in the springtime of 1979 conceptualizing the Macintosh project by writing a series of papers called the Macintosh Papers. Just detailing his ideas of how to extremely simplify, make a really, really simple computer. And the ideas included, Jeff was exposed to the work at Xerox PARC, and he had the ideas of a bitmap display. But Jeff did not like the mouse, never did. He thought Jeff was really oriented toward, Jeff was a terrific writer, and he didn't like anything that would pull your hands off the keyboard. So he had this idea of doing the pointing with things he called leap keys. Although Jeff, when I wrote that in my book, he pointed out to me that at that time, the leap keys came later. Jeff had the brilliant idea of sending them plane tickets, even though Bill had turned them down. And when Bill got the plane tickets in the mail, they figured, oh, what the hell? I may as well fly down for the weekend. And so Jeff told him about his ideas for the Macintosh. This was still pretty early. This was in mid-1978, so the Lisa project hadn't even started yet. But Jeff had the foresight to ask Steve Jobs to take Bill out for lunch. And Steve was the one who really convinced Bill to come to Apple with an interesting argument about saying, well, you know, you read the technology journals, right? You know, the engineering publications. And Bill said, oh, yeah, I keep track of everything that's going on. And Steve said, well, you know, by the time an article gets in there, it's two years after it's invented due to the publishing cycle and everything. If you really want to be on the leading edge, you have to be down here at Silicon Valley. And Bill kind of that argument worked with Bill, and he dropped out of grad school and he started working out, becoming the first applications programmer. Actually, when the Apple II was announced, one of the applications, Mike Markla, who was the third founder of Apple, the business-oriented one, thought was would be perfect for it was tracking stocks with a modem. So they had to deal with Dow Jones to create the Dow Jones stock tracker or something like a portfolio manager it was called. The Dow Jones portfolio manager. And they advertised it in the first brochure, which came out in late 1977. And so Bill started at Apple in June of 1978, and his job was to write the portfolio manager, which they had already advertised, but never really, Mike Markla had in BASIC, mocked it up, and that's what they used to announce it. But his first job was to write this program that was already announced and was supposed to ship in a week or two. Anyway, Bill became one of the first great programmers at Apple, and Jeff went on to recruit Bud Tribble, who was also another one of his students at UCSD, and the entire early Mac team. I tell the story in my book of how Bill Atkinson introduced Brawl to Jeff, saying, hey, this is the guy who'll design your Mac for you, and Jeff said, we'll see about that, but it turned out to be true. Jeff had an interesting personality. I have one of my favorite stories in the book is just a little story about it. It tells you something about Burl's personality, too. Burl was an incredibly creative character. One of the things he could really do well is imitations of all the other people on the Mac team. He especially liked to imitate the authority figures. So his imitation of Jeff went something like, Jeff had this mannerism with his hands holding his fingers together. He also had a slight stammer. And so Jeff would imitate Jeff by saying, why, I invented the Macintosh. And then we'll switch to a different voice, like a radio announcer voice, which I can't do justice to, but the radio announcer, it's also Burl would say, No, I thought that Burl invented the Macintosh. And then Jeff would come back, but he'd switch to his Jeff voice and go, why, I invented Burl. So I'll show you something both about Jeff's personality. Well, Jeff did have a tendency to think that whatever idea you had, he had invented it at some earlier point. And sad, this is a really sad story, and it points out one of the difficulties of writing a book like this, and that I really had to struggle with every step of the way, was I betraying the confidences of my friends at different points by saying different things? You know, when you work closely with people, especially intensely, you know, they don't expect you to write a book about it. And so I thought maybe the statute of limitations saved me because I waited 20 years. But even still, you get into different things. And Jeff didn't like my book. He especially didn't like that I invented Burl story. And once he found out about my book, he kind of went on the warpath against it. And it turns out I ended up, Jeff, in December of 2004, just as my book was coming out, he was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer and he passed away a month or two later. And I felt terrible that my book was vexing him on his deathbed. No jokes here, it just was horrible. But I wanted to say that without Jeff, there certainly would have been no Macintosh. And even though Jeff was, you know, boy, I viewed almost mentally ill about taking credit for the Mac, even though his ideas, Jeff just started the project, and Jeff contributed so much to the spirit of the machine. But the core ideas he opposed. He didn't like the mouse. He was resistant to switching over to the 68,000 microprocessor, which was, if we had stuck with his 6809 microprocessor, the Mac never could have had much of a life because its 16-bit address space would have been saturated just a year initially. It would have been saturated. But and Jeff, I think, on purpose, kind of confused initiating the product with designing it all. But still, I have the deepest respect for Jeff, and I wouldn't be here, I wouldn't have written my book, I wouldn't have had my career if it wasn't for Jeff. So this is a photo of the Macintosh design team, and something really curious happened with the Macintosh, which is, for a reason I'll explain shortly, Steve Jobs decided to give credit to the actual people who designed the Macintosh, which is very unusual. Usually companies don't want to reveal the names of the engineers because immediately they'll get job offers. And that's the philosophy that prevails at Apple and elsewhere today. You know, Apple does not give credit to people doing the technical work because of those competitive reasons. But it turns out the Lisa, which was the Macintosh's predecessor, when it came out, I have a story in my book called Credit with Due. I won't tell the whole story now, but it turns out some interviews in the magazines came out with the engineering managers of the Lisa, and not Bill Atkinson. Bill Atkinson was left out of all the publicity for the Lisa, even though he designed, he was the almost, he wasn't the sole creator of the UI, but he was far and away the main creator of it, and the sole creator of the quick draw graphics package that was the heart and soul of the software. And Bill was incredibly despondent when he saw other people getting the credit for essentially his work. Something like that had happened to him earlier in his career when he was still a student at UCSD. He did a groundbreaking animation of the brain using his skills as a photographer as well as a programmer to take slices of the brain and create an animation so you could do a 3D walkthrough of the brain. This was in the mid-70s. It was very groundbreaking for the time. It was printed on the cover of Scientific American, I think, an edition of Scientific American in 1978. I can't remember the month. But the professor who Bill did it for took all the credit. Bill did not get his name even on the main academic paper that published it. And then here it was like deja vu. It was happening again to him. He almost quit Apple. But he went to Steve and they rectified the situation in various ways. But one of the ways was that Steve promised Bill that the engineers, the designers, would get credit for the Macintosh. And so we had lots of publicity photos. It turns out it's problematic, though. I can't even say it's a good idea, even though I kind of benefited from it. Because how do you draw the line? There's maybe 15 people who made key contributions to the Macintosh in various ways, but you couldn't have them all. Steve arbitrarily designated 7 people, not including himself, to be the ones. And if you were the 8th person, you felt pretty bad about it. I don't think there's any right answer there. You want to give credit to the people really doing the work, but there's no good way to do it. So anyway, as part of that, Steve had this wild idea that we were going to promote the Macintosh by having the actual designers talk about it in a series of TV commercials. And as part of, I talked a little bit of finding out about the Apple corporate marketing archive, and the greatest find I had, I knew that they had sort of done these commercials. They had to be somewhere. They weren't indexed in that FileMaker database, but I looked really hard for it, and we found a tape with outtakes of the commercials. So I thought it would be really fun to run some of these for you, because they really bring these characters I wrote about in the book to life. And so that's a plan. This first one was the overview. I hope we can hear it. Turn up the sound on the computer. We need the sound.
Turn the whole world off.
I'll start it again just so you can hear that. It starts with a blank screen. But
yeah, we designed Macintosh really because we wanted one for ourselves and we couldn't get one. And Apple turned it into a product to turn the whole world off to what we've got. I think really Mac is a big extension of who we think we are and where we think we're going. And that's why we designed the product.
So we set out to capture the greatness of Lisa in something affordable to individuals rather than corporations.
It had to be easy to manufacture. It had to be very reliable because we didn't want our customers to ever have to worry about it failing. And it had to cost roughly 1/4 as much as anything I'd ever designed before.
Demonstrating a Macintosh is the only way to do it. You've got to show somebody. I can't really describe it to you in words, but if I can get you to sit in front of it and play with it, you won't let go of it.
And I think what you're going to see is that the balance of power is going to shift. The balance of power from companies running people to hopefully people running companies.
We were just trying to make something incredibly great, and I think we did.
So the commercials never ran because they were deemed to be too self-congratulatory and not enough focused on the product. Just as the Macintosh introduction was coming up, it was when the IBM PC started really taking off in the fall of 1983. And so Apple was a little bit defensive. And for a variety of reasons, they decided not to go with these. But I have some outtakes. I think they're so fun, it's worth showing you some more of them. So Here's one featuring just Burl. This is my favorite one. I call it Liberating Electrons. You'll see why.
I'd say we want to do a lot of things like the Apple II and really get good synergy between hardware and software. And I really think of it as sort of a kind of way to liberate electrons. And, 32 million times a second, we're letting a lot of electrons free to do what we want for people. And I think that's really neat.
I think of myself as a cross between an artist and an inventor. The medium that I use to do my art with is this programming stuff that's like a modeling clay. When I make changes to a program, I try to create something, and then I have to sort of try it out on people. Oftentimes, some of the things that I think are very intuitive end up being difficult for people to understand. I have to go back and work with the medium a lot more. MacPaint has been through 12 major rewrites, and each time I've managed to make it simpler and more powerful at the same time. And I think just going back and being willing to try it out on a lot of people and really be honest about what things are hard to do and what things can match the way people think about it, and having a good rapport with the people that will be using it, that's what really makes a program easy to understand.
Dr. Shaw, I know I'm running late here, but run just a couple, worth doing a couple more of these?
Sure.
This is Susan Kerr, who was my friend from high school.
If you're an artist and you're skilled with media, this is a new medium that offers great control turning off. There's 1,000 little dots in half an inch, and you have the capacity, either real or magnified, to turn off and on each one of those dots. So on a screen that's fairly big, or a piece of paper 8.5 by 11, you've just got so many scads of dots. There's nothing really that you can't present on that screen. All you do to print, unlike most computers where you hit a control key and a print key sequence. You just hit one button, it says print, and it prints. And you can actually donate it so you can watch on the screen the whole document gradually being printed and follow your progress. It's pretty nifty.
One more, I think this last one is with me.
I expect to be totally amazed at what people are going to do with Macintosh. Every person, a unique individual, brings something to the machine, just as the machine brings something to them. And the interaction between the two makes amazing things happen. And I expect people to use Macintoshes to totally blow my mind 2 years out. You know, the incredible energy that's going to be put into it is really going to do some amazing things.
So, I've got a lot more stories. I got to do this one more. This one, I'll just do it really fast, but this is appropriate because we're in New York now. We made this trip to New York in December 1983. We were accompanied by Steve Jobs would attract all kinds of crazy characters hanging around with him, because by that time he was an international celebrity, right on the cutting edge of revolution affecting lots of people's lives. So we had this guy named Jean-Claude Pigozzi, who's, I still read about him every once in a while. He's a true jet setter, as well as a photographer. He was an heir. His dad, I think, started the Renault Motor Company in Italy. And he would hang out with us, and he accompanied us to this trip to New York, this whirlwind trip that we got to be on the cover of Newsweek. I tell you, this cover of Newsweek, Can We Keep the Sky Safe, was supposed to be the Macintosh, but it got pulled because the San Jose Mercury printed the fact that we had the cover sewn up on Friday before it was supposed to be printed Monday, and that was enough to get them to drop it. And anyway, during this trip to New York, there's a lot of stories I could tell, but we're running out of time. But I wanted to show this one picture. This is the picture that my editors begged me to put in the book, but I decided we just couldn't, and you'll see why. That's the main IBM building in New York
City, and that's Steve Jobs here expressing how he felt about IBM. Pagosi took the picture,
but he couldn't come out to dinner with us, and Steve wasn't around. He gave it to me to give to Steve, but I managed to misplace it. I never gave it to Steve. He doesn't know I have it. He probably doesn't even know it exists. But I figured I just couldn't put it in the book, but I can get away. It'll be on Google Video. There's another one that I wish we could have put in the book. We just couldn't track down the rights to it. But it's a cartoon of Steve yelling at Burl and me, cajoling us to get the sound software finished by Monday, or he was going to remove it from the prototype. And there's a bunch of other stories, but I guess we should open up for questions now because I'm 15 minutes late.